Welcome to the Voices of Grambling, a digital oral history podcast, a series exploring the rich, nuanced history of Grambling State University, the city of Grambling, and the people who make it. This series is a collaborative project between students and faculty of the History Department of Grambling State University, as well as faculty from the University of Arkansas. The Voices of Grambling, a digital oral history project, has been made possible in part
by a grant from the Albert LePage Center for History and the Public Interest at Villanova University. This season is part of their Cities and Historical Perspective thematic investigation and will focus on the economic, racial, and social history of the city of Grambling through conversations with former business owners and city officials.
Any views, findings, conclusions, or recommendations expressed in this podcast do not necessarily represent those of
the LePage Center for History and the Public Interest, the National Endowment for the Humanities, the Social Science Research Council, the Louisiana Endowment for the Humanities.
Greetings. I am Yanice Days, a GSU history instructor. Today, I have the honor and privilege of interviewing the Honorable Dolores Wilkerson Smith, current mayor pro tempore for the city of Grambling and the daughter of one of the city's most prominent business owners, political activist, and community leaders, Mr. Calvin Wilkerson. Welcome, Mrs. Smith.
Good morning.
Now I will allow you an opportunity to introduce yourself.
I'm Dolores Wilkerson Smith. I'm a product of the Grambling community, having attended elementary and high school in Grambling. After that, I went to New Orleans and got a degree in accounting from Dillard University. Following that, I went to Atlanta University and got an MBA with a concentration in finance. I spent a year in Detroit working for General Motors and then moved back to Grambling and was employed at Grambling State University until I retired. I'm also the wife of Leon Smith. We've been married 51 years. We have two daughters, Elizabeth, who's an attorney, and Burgundy, who teaches special education.
Don't you want to elaborate on those grandbabies?
Well, now, I have uniquely, since we're in the radio station, my oldest granddaughter, Raven, is a graduating senior at Texas Southern University, but she got her start right here at KGRM when she was in high school, announcing over here with Miss Evans.
Would you share with us what it was like growing up in Grambling?
The phrase, "it takes a village to raise a child," is what it was like growing up in Grambling. Because if you did something wrong, your parents knew it before you got home. Because somebody else was going to not only straighten it out where they were, and they felt comfortable that they could straighten it out, but they would also inform your parents. But it was a great opportunity growing up in Grambling. By being in Grambling, even though Grambling was a small town, it was a university town, and we were able to come on the campus and be introduced to a lot of cultural items that you didn't have to go places to in order to, you know, enhance your background and your development. So it was a great thing to grow up in Grambling.
What do you remember of the businesses in Grambling growing up?
When I think about the businesses in Grambling, what I think about was there was a time when Grambling was self-sufficient, meaning that we had our own grocery store. We had our own cleaners. We had tailor shops. We had clothing stores. We had places where you could go and sit down and eat. We had a financial institution, the credit union, as well as a bank at one time. So at one point, Grambling was pretty self-sufficient, meaning that you didn't have to leave Grambling to get the things that you needed.
What were some of those places to eat in Grambling?
You had Penny's Cafe, which was across the street from the collegiate shop. You had Jones Brothers Barbecue. You had Alice's Cafe. Long time ago, you had Don's Dairy Queen. I don't know if that might have been before your time.
Indeed,
That's where, on the corner where Bowman's place is now.
You had
a Dairy Queen there.
Isn't that something?
Uh-huh.
Amazing. What about places to socialize in Grambling?
There were no places to socialize in Grambling. You socialized at school. Or if there were school activities, you socialized at church, or if there were activities after church for the youth, and then you socialized at your homes. But there was really not a lot of socializing that took place in Grambling.
So now we're going to look at the business aspect, and I want to start with your family's business by asking, how did the collegiate shop get started?
The collegiate shop was born out of necessity. My father was a teacher. He graduated from Grambling College. My mother graduated from Grambling College, and they were both teachers. My father, however, was very involved in getting individuals registered to vote. So in the process of trying to get individuals registered to vote, my father was fired. Hmm. And my mother could not work in Lincoln Parish. And so she took myself and my two sisters, and we moved to Minden, and we stayed in the back of a black doctor, had an office there, and he had an apartment in the back of his office. And we would stay there during the week, and she would come home on the weekends. And my dad, in order to provide for his family, he started peddling merchandise. He would go and get a few things and come back and sell them, and go get a few more things and come back and sell them. And it developed into a business.
Now, you and I had a discussion previously in that business, Collegiate Shop, but it had a different name. And how did the name come about for the store?
Because it was a college town, the name came up with Collegiate. But it started off as Collegiate Sportswear. However, we realized that, or my dad did, that most of the merchandise that was in there was not sportswear, but it was clothes for not only for college students, but for everybody. So he changed the name from Collegiate Sportswear to Collegiate Shop.
Do you recall what year that store opened?
Probably 1957.
Aside from clothes, eventually we know that it did grow.
Yes, my father had an idea that he wanted high-end merchandise. He wanted clothes that spoke for themselves. And so when he started to buy clothes, or when he looked at brands, he looked at brands such as Stacy Adams. He looked at brands such as Stacy Adams shoes for men, J. Renee shoes for women. He looked at, they don't sell them now, but used to be Lily Ann suits, Butnick suits. He wanted merchandise that, when you wore these clothes, it made a statement. We also had Fashion Fair. We did Hanes Hose. You could come in the store and you could get everything that you needed. At one point, we sold lingerie. We sold stockings. We did jewelry. So you could be completely outfitted from the head to the toe for the collegiate shop for both men and women. Now, what we did not sell was a lot of children's clothes.
I can recall the fond memories that I had to be able to get exposed to some of those brand names growing up that possibly would not have been able to, but because the store was located here in Grambling. And in that it was in a collegiate town, we do know that you all provided services for different groups at the university.
We provided services, but we also provided jobs. There are a lot of individuals that will tell you that I got my first job, or when I was in high school, working at the collegiate shop, or when I was in college, I was able to come to the collegiate shop. Interesting tidbit that people may not realize, that Doug Williams had an older brother named Robert. Robert played baseball, but Robert was also the tailor at the collegiate shop.
Wow.
He did the alterations. So he preceded Doug in coming to Grambling. Yeah, we did a lot of employees, and that gave people in the community jobs, okay?
What about tuxedo rentals?
Yes. We had in-house tuxedos, and we used to do, until we closed, we did the tuxedos for the Carnation. We also did the tuxedos for Calendar Girl. When the band went to Japan, the collegiate shop provided white tuxedos that they wore in Japan. My father had an excellent relationship with Conrad Hutchinson, and so we also were here and available when the band students would come in and they needed to get the clothes that they had to have, the black suits and the shoes and the gloves or whatever. We had all that type of merchandise and provided it for the students.
Where did the merchandise come from, and how did the merchandise get to the store?
Yes, my father used to go to Dallas to the merchandise mart, and he would buy clothes there, and they would ship them in. When he first started, he would go and buy a few things. Because what you have to realize is that it takes a lot of money to run a business, to run a store. Let me give you an example. Let's just say you buy shoes. Well, if you buy one shoe, you got to have everything from size 6 to size 12, including half sizes. And then if you get it in three different colors, so if you got a dozen shoes, and then if you get it in three different colors, you got three dozen pair of that one shoe. And so in order to sell shoes, you got to have more than one style. So you may have 10 styles. And so if you got to have three dozen of 10 styles, so it took a large investment of money in order to be able to get to where he was. And so it was a building process. Like I said, when he first started, he started as a peddler, going and get what he could afford and come back and sell that, and then go and get some more and come back and sell that, until he was able to get up to where he could in terms of being able to purchase enough merchandise to have a really fully stocked business.
I want to touch on this. As you mentioned, he sold high-end goods. He allowed people to charge their purchases, and I wanted to mention that because I do know, and I recall, and this is not my story, but I can recall growing up with my grandparents and us going to the store, grocery store, and they put it on the account and you pay at the end of the month. But I do know that existed at Collegiate Shop, because I want to say that was probably my first experience of having or getting credit.
We did. We carried our own accounts at the Collegiate Shop, where individuals could come in and open an account, and they could buy the merchandise and come back later and pay for it. We sent out statements every month to customers. We also had layaways where you could come in, and if there's something that you wanted and you couldn't quite pay for it right then, you could put it in layaway and make a deposit on it and come back and pay on it until you could fully pay it off. And oftentimes, there were individuals who could not get credit other places. But my father, given his background and where he came from and how he started, because he was first generation college in his family, okay?
Okay.
So he didn't have any help from his family in terms of background to get started. You know, he made it on his own. So he was aware and he was sensitive to other individuals that were trying to make it on their own, that did not necessarily have a savings account or a bank account to be able to come in and buy everything that he needed. For example, you'd have students that were getting ready to go on an interview and they needed a suit. And a lot of times he would just give them the suits. I'm not going to call a name, but there was a young man that my father worked with him to get him to go back to college. And he said when he finally went home and told his mama that my dad had helped him get in college, he said his mama cried. And then when he got his BEOG, that's what you call the Pell Grants now, he came and he brought his check to my daddy, and my daddy said, "No, that's your money. Go and use that money. What I did for you, I did for you. I'm not expecting anything back in terms of it." And so he was able to take that money, and then my daddy helped him get his books. And so he did a lot of things, and this business allowed him to be able to help a lot of people along the way.
So I know you mentioned that your mother was a teacher. Did she have a role with the business at all?
She did not work directly in the business, but she had a very significant role in the business, because it's hard to be in business when you don't know how much money you're going to have at the end of the month. They lived off of my mother's check, which allowed my father to be able to reinvest anything that he was making in the business back in the business. And because she had a teaching job, that meant that she carried the insurance. So she didn't work in the business every day, but she had a significant role because it allowed him to be able to do the business and to be able to, you know, to be able to pay the bills, not only for the business, but the bills for our household.
Did you or any of your siblings have a role in the store at its early inception or beginnings?
Yes. You know, it's interesting. I got a notice one time from Social Security, and they were talking about the number of quarters that I had. And they had all of the quarters down that I had, and I went back and I noticed that when I was 15, I got paid $25 from the Collegiate Shop. But because they took Social Security out of that, that counted as a quarter.
Awesome.
Because you only have to work 1 month in a quarter for you to get the whole quarter. So that helped me get my 40 quarters with Social Security. So, yes, I was working in the business probably in the summers or in the evenings from when I was 15 years old.
I got to ask about Pinky. Did she work in the store?
Yes,
we
both did. The interesting thing is, one thing I learned from my dad about the store is he believed that there were two things that you had to have. You had to have a good accountant, and you had to have a good lawyer. So the people that he had that were doing the books, the day-to-day books that were done in the business were done by my aunt, who was the Ethel Garner, who was the first registrar of Gramlin's wife. Now, she didn't work in the business every day because she had a job at the university, well, at Gramlin College, but she would help him with his books. But then he had a CPA out of Ruston that did the taxes and sent in the tax, all that information every month. And then he had a good lawyer. But the interesting thing was, as a result of that, when you look back, I became the accountant and Pinky became the lawyer.
On a broader level, how significant was the collegiate shop outside of Grambling, but for the African-American community as a whole?
I think it was very significant. He had customers from all over the United States. You know, he had customers that would call from California, that would call from New York, or they may have gone to school here and wanted some products, or they came here for a football game and saw something they liked and wanted to come back or whatever. So he had customers from all parts of Louisiana and really from all parts of the United States in terms of wanting the merchandise that we had.
Do you think that what he, as you said, starting from nothing, gave opportunity for African Americans or made African American community proud and in a sense have some hope?
When you say hope, my dad, this is probably another story you haven't heard, my dad would have been a good inspirational speaker. My dad had one brother, and he would say it like this. My dad was the oldest. He was first grade. Then he said he was first grade and his brother was first grade. I said, so, Daddy, that means that you failed. He said, I didn't say that. So then he said he was first grade and his brother was second grade. So I said, so, Daddy, that means you failed first grade again. He said, I didn't say that. So he said he thinks that his mother moved from Homer back to Ruston to get him out of first grade, because my dad had spent 3 years in first grade. He never got out of the first grade. When they moved to Ruston, he just went on and got into second grade. He was never promoted to the second grade, but he would have been an inspirational person to say, it's not where you come, it's not where you start, it's where you finish.
Indeed.
And even though he spent, like I said, he spent 3 years in the first grade, and he would say also his mother died when he was in high school, and her last question to his other brother was, is he going to graduate from high school? She was concerned about him. Not only did he graduate from high school, but he graduated from college. I attended Dillard University with no scholarship. My daddy wrote the check and paid the whole tuition my whole 4 years. I got a master's from Atlanta University, and my daddy wrote the check and paid the tuition for both years. I would say he was extremely successful.
Very. How was your dad, Calvin Wilkerson, involved outside of the business community?
Because he had his own business, and because 99% of his customers were Black, he could say whatever he needed to say, and he could do whatever he needed to do. Like I said, he lost his job trying to get people registered to vote. He was very involved with voter registration and seeing that Blacks were treated fairly. Oftentimes, if individuals felt like somebody had been mistreated by the white race, they would come to my daddy and talk to him about it to try to find out what they could do. Oftentimes, people wanted to say something and wanted to do something, but because they feared the loss of their job or because they feared retaliation, they did not speak up. Well, my dad was one of those that was going to speak up, and he was going to do whatever he could to prevent the injustice. I can remember he was involved with the first Head Start. Actually, he was the director of the first Head Start that they had in Lincoln Parish. And that was because that was a way to help young Black children get a head start.
Prior to that, education did not exist for the younger children.
right.
that we knew as right. the Head Start. Is this the same Head Start
that they have now?
Uh-huh.
Yes.
Okay. Tell us about him serving on the school board. Lincoln Parish School Board, let me say.
He was elected, I want to say it was in 1973. He was elected to the Lincoln Parish School Board. Prior to that time, the school board did not have districts. And because you didn't have districts, then Grambling really never had anybody that, from Grambling that was represented on the school board. When they went back and created districts, and they put Grambling had two districts, so that allowed Grambling to have at least two representatives on the school board. He was elected to the school board, and he served probably until a couple of years before he passed on, he served on the school board. During that time, whenever there were racial issues, he spoke up. I remember clearly when they had the first black to be the queen at Ruston High, they wanted to call off the coronation. Yes, ma'am, they wanted to call it off because they had a black, and the parent and the black parents were very upset about it, and he worked very hard to ensure that everything went smoothly.
So let me ask, because this has been happening recently in the news that you see in different places. So she was the actual queen at Ruston High. It was no separation, no black and no white. It was just one queen, and a black queen was elected?
To the best that I can remember, yes. Uh-huh.
Was he the first representative for Grambling? I know we have two districts in Lincoln Parish.
Yeah, there were two elected at the same time. I think Ruth Bradford may have been the other individual that was elected, and so they both came on at the same time.
Aside from what you just mentioned about the queen at Ruston High, do you know of any tensions he may have encountered with the other white members of the board, school board?
Yes, because my daddy was going to always speak up and say what he thought, how he thought it, what he was always respectful of all of the persons on the board. But if a black teacher was moving or retired or whatever, he wanted to be sure that position was filled with another black. He was always concerned about the ratio of black teachers to white teachers as it related to the number of black and white children that they had in the classroom. I'll give you another example. At Grambling, the cafeteria was not air-conditioned.
This is the university campus, college?
No, this is at the high school.
Okay.
The cafeteria for the elementary and high school.
Okay.
It wasn't air-conditioned, okay? My daddy took half of his check that he got from the school board and gave it every month until they were able to use that money to put an air conditioner. Can you imagine people having to cook and eat in a kitchen that had no air? And so he would, whatever he was paid to be on the school board, he took half of that money and put that money toward having the air conditioning installed in the cafeteria.
We do know that you've mentioned about him losing his job from teaching because of attempting to get or getting black people registered to vote. Do you recall how long it was before you all were able to come back and your mother ended up being back employed in Lincoln Parish as a teacher?
I'm going to probably say that maybe the next year, because I don't remember going to school in Webster Parish other than that first year.
Tell us about some of his efforts to get blacks to vote.
Well, you know, back when that was taking place, you had to take tests in order to be able to register to vote. But, you know, when you say take tests, you have to understand that the tests may have been how many bubbles in a bar of soap? So how do you answer that? So what they would do is, and he didn't work necessarily by himself, but what they would do is they would get people who wanted to go and vote, and then they would teach them what they needed to know in order to be able to pass the test to register to vote. And that's why a lot of times when you look at the young people now, who all you can go online to register to vote, and you wonder, they don't really understand and realize what it cost so many blacks to be able to vote. Because, you had to take tests. You may have to know the parts of the Constitution. You had to, you had, and it required a lot. And so they would work with the people, and they would work with the churches who worked with the people who wanted to go and vote so that they could get registered. And then once you got registered, then you'd have to be able to get to the polls to vote. So they would take people to the polls to vote. They would have meetings and try to plan out strategies. And I can remember them talking about there was a black right there in Lincoln Parish Courthouse. You know, how they used to have two water fountains. They had one for the coloreds and then one for the whites. And this person was drinking water from the white water fountain. And one of the police down there took a billy club and broke her jaw.
A woman?
Yes. Just hit her and broke her jaw because she was drinking out of the wrong water fountain.
Mm.
So we don't do a good job of telling the story. That's why you see when it's time to go and vote, everybody over 60 is on their way to the polls. You know, they there early, okay? I can remember my aunt and her husband. At 6 a.m., she was calling my phone. We ready. I didn't even have to ask her ready for what. I know I was late because if I wasn't at her house at 6 o'clock to take her to the polls, she was calling. We ready. We ready to go vote. Because she remembered when she could not vote. She remembered how she was treated when she could not vote. And she remembered now that she could vote, how they treated her when she could vote. Because, see, sometimes for a lot of us, the only thing we have that they want is our vote. We don't necessarily have the money that they have, but we have our vote. And to get our vote, you know, it makes sometimes them treat you differently. And they remember stuff like that. And we don't do a good job of telling the story.
And when we think about voting, the greatest voter turnout that I happened to see in Grambling in 2008, I never, ever had to wait that long in line to cast a vote. And that was when then candidate who became president, Barack Obama, ran for president of the United States.
I can give you one a little bit better than that one. When, I can't think of his name right now.
David Duke. Was running against.
Was running for the governor of Louisiana. We were taking buses of individuals to get registered to vote to ensure that Louisiana did not elect David Duke. So we got it. And so there would be buses and people would have to stand in line just to get registered. Okay, but it doesn't do you any good to get registered unless you vote. On election day, the band, Grambling's band, got up and marched around the campus and woke everybody up and said, it's time to get up and go vote. And as a result of that, and it was done parallel all over the state, David Duke was not elected. Can you imagine what it would have looked like for the state of Louisiana to have the Grand Wizard of the Ku Klux Klan as our governor? And this is a significant time when our vote made a difference.
Indeed. And people just need to understand the power of the vote.
It is.
Your vote is your voice. Your dad played an integral part with the college system. So would you like to mention where else did he serve in state on the state level?
He was appointed by Dave Treen to the Louisiana Board of Trustees. I think it's called the Board of Supervisors now, but he was on the Board of Trustees, and that was the governing board for Grambling State University, Louisiana Tech. Everything but LSU and Southern were under that particular governing board.
Which is similar to, I guess, and it includes the ULS system.
Yes, that's what it is now.
Okay. If you recall, do you know if he may have been serving as the only African-American by himself on the board at the time of his appointment?
No, I don't think he was the only African-American. Now, he was the first African-American from North Louisiana to ever serve on that board, and I think he served in an at-large position.
Tell us about a little bit about this cooking school that operated back in the day.
As I said, my daddy was a master salesperson, okay? And he would go to towns in Louisiana or East Texas, Mississippi, and do what they called cooking schools. He would go into their community and he would find some ladies who were instrumental in the community and he would get them to get individuals to come to the cooking schools. But what he did was he went to companies. They would give away refrigerators and stoves, but they would also give away small products such as bread, rice, syrup, whatever. And so the cooking school, they had individuals who would demonstrate how to cook products. Actually, your mom, Rosetta Days, worked with him. And they would do the cooking and would show people how to cook different products and different items. He would tell jokes. He was great at telling jokes. And he would travel around with the cooking schools. And they might do anything from baking cakes to making fancy dishes. And it gave the individuals in that community something to do, some place to go, you know, to these cooking schools. And then they would win products. And at the end of the week, somebody would go home with a brand new refrigerator or stove or washing machine or something of that nature.
I was aware that my mother assisted with that. But what was so intriguing for me and my brother and I growing up, I want to say this may have been in the 80s. We had an opportunity, your daddy, if you will, rebooted the cooking school, and I got to go to one in South Louisiana, and it was sponsored by a company. And I happened to see this company's name come up, and I was going to research, but it was a company that sold rice. It was in South Louisiana, and they sponsored this. And sure enough, it's like you said, they gave away, I'm thinking they gave away a refrigerator. But to actually get to see what that was all about. And it reminds me of what we see on television today when you have chefs who are preparing dishes on television that you can see what they do. And that was just really, it was interesting. I had always heard about it, but to get to go and be a part, that was a very interesting event. And I guess in the sense when I asked you about socializing, I guess that was a place that people could socialize back in the day. So now let's talk about the transition of the collegiate shop from your dad operating the business to family members taking over.
Okay, my brother worked in the business also. As my dad grew older, my brother took over the management of the store. And then after my brother grew older, my husband took over the management of the store. So we had several generations that, you know, my children have worked in the store. I've worked in the store. My sister worked in the store. My brother. So we've had several generations to be involved in the business.
What ways did you recognize how the operation of the store changed from as it shifted from, let's say, or your dad's generation to you, your siblings?
Well, I guess there were changes as the times changed. In other words, as blacks began to be able to use credit cards and to get other forms of credit, we did less in terms of in-store credits. We did less in terms of layaways. As times changed and, you know, social media and being able to buy merchandise online. And when he started, you know, you had one way to get to Shreveport, and that was Highway 80. And so even going to Monroe was a trip, as opposed to now, if you decide you want to buy something, you might make two trips to Monroe in one day. Mm-hmm. But back when he first started, going to Shreveport or Monroe was like a major trip. So people tried to buy locally. But as the market expanded and as people, especially blacks, got more income and better transportation, you know, purchases were made from all kinds of places.
Would you say that they're greater, even, let's say, on a local level, closer to Grambling than Monroe or Shreveport? Let's say, Ruston, do you think that greater accessibility via transportation for people in Grambling to be able to get to Ruston had an impact on the business and the stores?
I'm sure it did, and it was probably more competition because you could go other places. And then there became a shift in the merchandise. There was a time that everybody dressed up to go everywhere. And then the trend became casual. Even now, especially with the young people, you can see young people in jeans in church and you're not offended and it's acceptable. When I was growing up, you didn't wear jeans to church. You know, you had to be dressed
in stockings.
Yes, in stockings. Right. Young people now probably most of them don't even wear stockings. And so you know, merchandise changed. The other thing that changed is that we became more involved with merchandise for the university. You know, as people started to wear more casual clothes, they started to purchase more items that had the name Grambling State University on it. And so we had to make shifts. You know, in order to survive, you have to make shifts when you see times changing. So you're going to have to make shifts in terms of what you sell. So if you notice that people are not dressing up as much, so then you have to sell more casual clothes. You have to sell more casual shoes. You know, if you notice that people want alternate ways of buying, in other words, young people don't have checks. They use their phones or they use cards or whatever, but they don't write checks. And so you have to change as the times change.
I hated to see the store close. We understand that as times change, because that was always my go-to, from casual to formal wear, and shoes especially. The J. Renee's that you all would have that you could not find anywhere else. And I can recall going in a store and seeing a J. Renee and coming back to you all and showing and telling you that's what I wanted to get it from you all. So we do miss that store. If you just briefly, if you wanted to touch on what happened, maybe why you all decided to close the store.
I don't know if there was any one particular thing. It was just time.
We do know you are Mayor Pro Tem, current Mayor Pro Tem, as a council member of the city of Grambling. What other ways are you involved in the town?
Other ways that I'm involved? I'm involved with the Pinky Wilkerson Life Development Center. We do public service activities that impact Lincoln, Bienville, Claiborne Parish. I'm also involved with my church. Like I'm on the Head Start board.
The same Head Start?
Yes.
Lincoln Parish? Oh, really?
Yes.
Okay. Now, I want to move into, I can hear Bess and her Aunt Pinky. So I want to move into our former state representative, the Honorable Pinky C. Wilkerson. What was she like as a person, as a sister, as a person too?
Pinky was in charge.
Okay.
she was in charge. She had the gift of gab. She liked to go, but she liked to help as many people as she could. You know, she liked to give back to the community or whatever, and she spoke her mind.
Aside from being a state representative, you touched on it briefly, and you mentioned her profession. By trade, she was an attorney.
Yes, she started off in private practice. And then she was an assistant district attorney for the 3rd District, which includes Lincoln and Union Parishes. She also served as an assistant attorney general for the state of Louisiana. And she also worked on Wall Street with Merrill Lynch. She was an attorney for them. That was all before she came back to Grambling and ran for state representative.
Do you recall, or you can speak on, her accomplishments during her time in office as state representative?
Pinky did so many things while she was state representative that it would be impossible to name them all, but I'm going to give you some examples. One was, after she was elected as state representative, she realized that there were individuals that didn't even have running water in their homes. And she didn't stop until she figured out how to get these individuals with running water. When the chicken plant in Arcadia was getting ready to close, and if it had closed, that would have meant that there were a number of people that worked there that wouldn't have been able to provide for their families. She didn't stop until she found another chicken company willing to come in and take over that plant. She also secured the funding for the Assembly Center here at the university. She secured the funding for the stadium support facility here at the university. She bought the city of Grambling a fire truck. She also authored the bill that named the stadium the Eddie Robinson Stadium. Now, she did a lot of big bills, and then she would do some that was little. I'm going to give you an example. At one time, we don't have phone books anymore, but at one time when we did have phone books, and they had merged Grambling and Simsboro all into one section of the phone book, and we couldn't get them to change it, she went back and authored a bill. And it became law that they had to be separate in the phone book. So she did big things, but she listened to her constituents, and she tried to do whatever was needed to be that she could do to help the people in District 11.
I would also like to add this one thing to one of her accomplishments that seniors in the District 11, senior citizens, and others within the community have the benefit of Community Coordinating Council, which she founded through funds from the legislature, and that is still, that organization is still in existence today.
Yes, that's true. She did that, and she was very concerned about the individuals in the community. And she would also like to always have youth involved in whatever she was doing. And so she would like the children to be able to get involved and to see what was going on. She also got $2.5 million for the baseball field, baseball and track field.
Okay. That's at the university.
That's
correct.
At the university, correct.
Okay. Something in Grambling, a couple of things that we could touch on.
This was after her death. The lights that you see on I-20 for the Grambling exit, she was responsible for that. Now, you may think, why would we have to have legislation to get lights on the interstate? But we did. And so, she did that. Now, my thinking, okay, and that came after she died, but she had done all of the legwork to get it done before she died. Another contribution that I think that she made is if you go to Shreveport right now where they're doing that construction, everywhere you go when they're doing construction, you're going to see the state police cars with blinking lights before you get into the construction zone. My sister was killed in Shreveport where they were doing construction, but that was before they had any state police. So I think that one of her greatest contributions was through her death. She probably saved a whole lot of lives because now they don't have construction zones without them being manned by police officers.
With regard to her legacy, some years later, that is called the Pinky C. Wilkerson Exchange at Exit 81 on I-20. And we are very appreciative of that, and with Senator Mary Landrieu, who is actually here to see that came to pass for us. I would like for you to mention briefly the foundation that you mentioned.
The Pinky Wilkerson Life Development Center was established in 2001. We went through the process of becoming a 501c3, which means that we're exempt from taxes and we're recognized by the federal government. We're also recognized by the state of Louisiana. We filed the annual reports to be recognized by the state of Louisiana. And it was formed in order to continue to do some of the things that she was doing while she was alive. We're very involved with the community and trying to make an impact on the community. We offer a scholarship every year. We also do a program, which is our signature program, called Read Me a Story. And this year, we were able to get from the state of Louisiana a set aside appropriation of $96,000 for that summer literacy program. But we've been involved in a lot of ways in touching lives in, like, say, Lincoln Parish, Bienville Parish, Claiborne Parish, those areas where she served as state representative.
And where is this located? I think it's significant where the foundation is actually housed.
The foundation is actually housed in her old law office. It was her law office up until her death, and now it's owned by that foundation.
In Grambling, Louisiana.
Yes, in Grambling.
What do you think your father's legacy, Pinky's legacy, would be? And you can take it from a political perspective or for having concern for African Americans, or just the community in general, and your legacy?
I think their legacy would be that my dad, my sister, my mom too, they were all concerned about leaving the world or leaving the space where they were better than they found it. What can I do to help somebody? What can I do to make improvements? You know, how can I help improve where I live and where I live, work, and play. And that's probably the main reason why I did run for the Grambling City Council, was because I felt like I could make a difference with my accounting and business background. I thought that I could make a difference.
So thank you, the Honorable Dolores Wilkerson-Smith. I want to thank you for your time, for coming to share with us today.
Thank you. I enjoy being here, and thank you for having me.
You've been listening to the Voices of Grambling, a digital oral history podcast, a production of the students and faculty of the Grambling State University History Department, along with faculty at the University of Arkansas. Be sure to listen in to one of our other episodes, and if you have a voice you would like to share or have a nomination for a voice that needs to be heard, please contact the History Department of Grambling State University for more information.